Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us. Above us only sky. Imagine all the people living for today.
Welcome, and my name is Anne Wilson, and it is my pleasure to host Emerge Australia's podcast series for 2026. This year, as in past years, I have the pleasure of interviewing clinicians and researchers from all over the world whose critical work is dedicated to ME/CFS, long COVID, and infection-associated chronic illnesses. I acknowledge the traditional custodians of country and their connections to land, sea, and community, and pay my respect to elders past and present, noting their continuing contributions, struggles, and achievements. As we continue to reflect on the magnificent lyrics of John Lennon's Imagine, I can't help but imagine a world where the brotherhood of man is celebrated globally, and for our listeners, a world without stigma or discrimination, a world where we have equity of access to treatments, clinical services, and cures. Now, that's something not only worth imagining, but actively visualizing and making it happen. So, in Long COVID Awareness Week 2026, to help us understand how we may achieve that, I'm delighted to welcome back Professor David Petrino to our podcast series. So welcome back, David.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's fantastic to speak to you again. So David needs little introduction to our listeners who are so well-versed in your work, David. You're a trained physiotherapist before completing a PhD in neuroscience. You're currently professor in the Department of Rehabilitation and Human Performance at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York City, and you are the Nash Family Director of the Cohen Center for Recovery from Complex Chronic Illness. I could go on and on, David, because your background is illustrious, but instead I'd like to just get straight into today's interview. Great to have you with us. And thanks so much for making the time to speak to me today.
Looking forward to chatting.
Yeah, so it's been a while since we last spoke. And to kick us off, could you give us a bit of a glimpse, an insight into some of the most significant pieces of work you've been working on since we last did a podcast with you, which was actually in May 2024? Particularly, I guess, given this is Long COVID Awareness Week, your work and your clinical trial work in Long COVID.
Yeah, absolutely. I think some of the most important work that we've been doing since 2024 has been, I'll say, in two chunks. You know, we continue to try and understand the pathobiology of Long COVID and try to understand exactly how and why this disease state is making people so ill. And a big goal of ours is, I think many of us have heard the phrase, you know, like that sometimes we have lumpers and we have splitters. You know, there are some people who want to lump things together and say, these are disease states that are similar. And you have people who want to split things apart and say, this is, you know, a different form of the same thing. And you know, a lot of our work is in the research side around pathobiology is really delving into the splitting. We're trying to understand all the different manifestations, not just of long COVID, but of ME/CFS, of people who come to us with chronic tick and vector borne illness, and trying to understand, okay, what is your constellation of symptoms and biomarkers and what make them specific, you know? And one of the studies that I think was really important that we sort of got out into the world in a preprint around 2025, late 2024, 2025, but we've continued to build on the work and it has actually become, you know, quite striking, is a publication that we made around passive transfer of antibodies. So what that means is we took antibodies from people with long COVID, IgG antibodies, and we took antibodies from healthy controls, and we injected those antibodies into mice. And what we noted was that the mice that received antibodies from the healthy controls were fine. They experienced no symptoms, whereas the mice that received antibodies from folks with long COVID went on to develop symptoms. And not only did they go on to develop symptoms, a subset went on to develop symptoms, but depending on the symptom that the human had, the mice started developing similar symptoms. The most striking in that study for us was people with long COVID who developed new onset neuropathic pain, which is nerve pain. When their IgG was passively transferred to the mice, the primary symptom that the mice developed was increased thermal sensitivity on their paws, which indicates we use that in the animal research world as a proxy for pain. And so this was really interesting because it's not all the people with long COVID that can elicit these symptoms in mice, but it's a subset. And what it tells us about this subset is this subset is most likely experiencing their symptoms as a result of autoimmunity. Yeah. And so this is the group that we give autoimmune medications to. So this is the group that is going to respond to IVIG, FcRn inhibitors, you know, and drugs of those natures that try to push down the driving of these functional autoantibodies. So that's one group that we've sort of discovered. In the same vein, we actually just have some research that we're completing with the PolyBio Research Foundation and Marcello Freire from the J. Craig Venter Institute, where we actually did gut biopsies in people with long COVID and healthy controls who were just having a routine colonoscopy. And interestingly, in both cohorts, we identified persistent antigen in the colon. So In both cohorts, we saw spike was persisting. The first thing that is interesting about that is in the long COVID cohort, there was much more spike. So significantly more spike than in the control cohort. But the other thing that was interesting was we ran a specific analysis that is called reverse transcriptomics, where we looked at not just hey, we could find spike in tissue, but we looked at the way that the spike was interacting with the tissue around it. And in the healthy controls, the spike, it wasn't really doing anything. In the people with long COVID, the spike was causing agitation of the tissue, and it was causing proliferation of proteins that are associated with inflammation, with oncogenic processes, so processes that can cause tumor growth and things of that nature, and other proteins associated with immune dysregulation. So we saw very clearly the fact that even if there is persistent spike in all of us at this stage, for reasons that we still need to discover, it's causing problems in the long COVID cohort. That's research that we're going to be releasing this year. And that is, you know, that subset of people, the people who have spike protein in their gut and it's causing problems, these are the folks that are going to respond well to monoclonal antibodies, to targeted antiviral treatments, you know, things of that nature. So those are some of the exciting research updates on the pathobiology side. And we have a lot of other really exciting papers coming out this year that are diving us, you know, down the rabbit hole of biomarker discovery and helping us get to a really clear diagnostic of long COVID, ME/CFS. In fact, you know, we have been working with Rob Wust's team in the Netherlands to sort of replicate his muscle biopsy work, which is showing some similarities in vascular dysfunction between people with long COVID and ME-CFS. And we're also working on some metabolomic work with a group at Princeton University, where we may, it's early now, but we may be able to see some differences between pre-2020 ME-CFS and people with long COVID in the metabolomic structure of their blood. So the sorts of things and substances that are being expressed as a result of the way they metabolize substances and the way that their body is producing energy. So these are really important biomarker studies that can help us to more precisely diagnose people with disease states that can then lead to drug discovery, clinical trials, etc.
That sounds amazing. I'm really interested in what you're talking about, you know, looking at the gut, because, you know, there's obviously big questions about the gut microbiome and its role in ME-CFS, for example. Can you comment on that?
Absolutely. You know, I think some of the first cases of ME-CFS were tightly linked to enteroviruses. And, you know, enteroviruses are viruses that we know often will persist in the gut because, you know, the gut, this immunotolerant environment, it's an environment that actually, unlike most environments that try to fight off invaders, the gut is a place where, well, you have all of these bacteria living around and you have all of these sort of different potential pathogens that are just sort of thriving in the gut. And so the gut is designed to actually encourage that sort of thing because you need your microbiome to break down food. And so because you need your microbiome to break down food, it can also be more tolerant than it should be of other pathogens that are sort of sneaking in there and causing discord and causing problems. And as a result, there have been a number of really interesting microbiome studies in both long COVID and ME-CFS showing clear microbiome dysregulation and showing persistence of pathogens that may not be as innocent as your, you know, your typical gut flora that helps you break down food and make energy.
Yeah. You mentioned early on Lyme disease and vector-borne diseases. As you know, it's not, whilst there's a lot of patients in Australia who are, you know, so wanting help in that area, Australia hasn't necessarily been very forthcoming about addressing vector-borne diseases. How is that work linked? Because I, for one, don't understand it fully. I understand some very basics from a lay perspective. Can you talk a little bit about the inclusion of Lyme in your work?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's funny because as an Australian, I often get asked by Americans, you know, like, what's the difference between, you know, Australia and America? And I often tell them, you know, it's funny. It's like, sometimes it feels like you're living in a time capsule. It's like, some things in America are like 25 years behind Australia, and some things in America are like 25 years ahead of Australia. And when it comes to the recognition of chronic tick and vector-borne illness, Australia is definitely 25, 50 years behind the United States. And it is an area that in some ways it's hard to believe that, you know, you still can't diagnose someone with Lyme disease in Australia easily. And tick and vector-borne illnesses exist. If we just go back to the basics, there is absolutely no question that they exist. Some of the most common tick and vector-borne illnesses are called the three Bs. You know, we have Borrelia burgdorferi, which is the bacteria associated with Lyme disease. We have Bartonella, which is also sometimes associated with things called cat scratch fever. That's the sort of bacteria that causes, you know, the sort of like wounds that a cat might make if it scratches you to swell out and get infected. And we have Babesia, which is a parasite that is also carried by ticks. And what's interesting about many of these pathogens is that we're now learning over and over again that they can persist for many years in the body. Work by Mickey Tal at MIT has shown that Borrelia has this tendency to burrow into ligaments and tendons in the body. It likes collagen, so it hides in joint surfaces. And in fact, and this may sound a little familiar to you, and you know, with the ME/CFS and the long COVID patients that you've heard from, what happens in animal models in Mickey's lab after Borrelia has burrowed into the collagen of these animals for a while is their joints become hypermobile. And they start to experience hypermobile joint disorders. So that's one way that these pathogens can hide. Another way that they can hide, and this is really prevalent in Bartonella and Babesia and has been verified in many animal studies, is that Bartonella and Babesia actually tend to hide in the endothelium. So they hide out in the blood vessels of those hosts that they're infecting. And one of the reasons that we think that we're seeing a lot more attention on tick-borne illnesses, at least in the United States, is because what does SARS-CoV-2 do with its spike protein circulating through the bloodstream? It agitates the endothelium. It causes inflammation of the endothelium. If you look at the plethora of papers that has been written by Ricia Pretorius, was first to the mark, and then many of her colleagues, we see endothelial dysfunction being driven by this circulating spike protein. And so the idea being, here's your Bartonella and Babesia not causing any problems, just sort of hanging out in your blood vessels. And now comes the spike protein that agitates them. And now they get riled up, they cause inflammation, they get reactivated. And now you have, you know, a bit of a mess going on with chronic tick-borne illness as well as potentially long COVID. So as we started to see this evidence emerging, that was where we were very sort of adamant about the fact that we had to create a clinic that would see everyone, you know, not just a clinic that was like, hey, we're long COVID and nothing else, or we're long COVID, but we're not going to even explore the possibility that you might have EBV reactivation driving your symptoms as opposed to viral persistence, or you might have, you know, Borrelia burgdorferi driving your symptoms as opposed to dysautonomia. So that was where we felt we had to learn from everyone.
Yeah. And is it possible to sort of have all three? Like, you know, it's like, is there difficulty distinguishing or splitting? You know, if you've got someone that comes in with a plethora of symptoms, it, you know, is it possible that they've actually maybe been activated by EBV, have got ME/CFS, but have also had, you know, one of the three Bs associated with Lyme? So you get this plethora of symptoms that need to be addressed.
No, absolutely. And one of the things that we are, you know, aggressively chasing over the next couple of years with our research is just improving diagnostic testing and improving the certainty of diagnostic testing, because these illnesses have been denied for so long that our ability to test is so pathetic right now. You know, we really don't have perfect measures for understanding who has what.
Yep.
So a big part of what we're trying to achieve is going head to head with a lot of tests and validating like what shows up as positive across five different tests versus what shows up as positive on only one test, and so on and so forth. But, and you know, what can be a false positive, because if you've got a crazy EBV reactivation, maybe, you know, you test positive for Borrelia or Babesia as well. You know, so these are all things that we need to better understand with the testing paradigms. But there are a lot of commercially available tests that are getting better and better and better. And it's an exciting time for pathogen diagnostics. But right now, you know, I certainly think that any of these things are possible. What we are learning over and over again is that many of the pathogens that we were told could sort of fade away with no consequence. You get infected with EBV and, you know, like for the last 30 years, the narrative has been like, everyone has EBV, it's no big deal. You know, now that was the narrative, you know. Now we're starting to learn that, you know, EBV may be linked to MS, EBV may be linked to Parkinson's disease. EBV may be linked to all of these other health sequelae that actually maybe it wasn't so inconsequential, you know, same as HPV. These are things that what we were told was just a fact of life. This is something that you're going to get exposed to, but don't worry. Everyone's exposed to it. It doesn't really cause some problems. Now we're starting to see, well, actually these pathogens are not without consequence.
Yeah.
And so the next step on from that realization is owning the mistake. Okay, we made the mistake. These pathogens do have consequences. How do we detect them? How do we destroy them? And that's the work that needs to happen urgently over the next few years.
Wow, that's amazing. Thank you for that, expert. I learned so much in that, and at some stage you and I'll talk more. But I want to take you back to your long COVID clinical trials and your rigorous assessment of post-exertional malaise. And from our perspective at Emerge Australia, PEM is a huge issue, particularly in our clinical education, because, you know, it always sort of slides under the radar, isn't recognized by clinicians. How do you see better recognition of PEM resulting from some of these long COVID clinical trials that you're doing?
Yeah, you know, I think first and foremost, it's just nice to see that people are measuring PEM as an outcome in clinical trials. So we're not just talking about fatigue. We're not just talking about 6-minute walk test or, you know, or something like that. We're actually using a DePaul symptom questionnaire for PEM to screen for PEM. We're actually using something like the FunCat to measure the severity of PEM and see if PEM severity is changing over time with respect to an intervention. So having validated instruments to be able to identify and then measure the severity of PEM is really important. I do think we need to go further. I've been fairly upfront about the fact that I'm not the biggest fan of exercise-based PEM evaluations. So like things like the 2-day CPET. Well, and you know many people with ME/CFS and the idea of bringing them in for not just one but 2 cardiopulmonary exercise tests is not a scalable solution for people who are severe and very severe. So what I get excited about is things like continuous lactate monitoring. If we extrapolate from the work of Rob Wust and his team, we see that in people with severe PEM, their body switches on. Well, we have 2 ways of generating energy. We have aerobic, where our body just uses energy, and that's uses oxygen to generate ATP. And that's something that we can do all the time, you know, like, you know, so long as we're awake, so long as we're alive and breathing, we can use, you know, this aerobic respiration to create ATP. And then there's anaerobic. It's less efficient. It's not so good. It's quick and dirty, but it starts to happen when you're really pushing yourself into the anaerobic threshold. So the anaerobic way of generating energy is when, let's say, you're on a treadmill pushing yourself really hard and your body is running out of oxygen to turn into energy, it switches over to this anaerobic thing, which you can only maintain for a little bit of time. And this is where your muscles start to burn, your lungs start to burn, because you're producing lactic acid, which is acid, so it burns. And that's a waste product of anaerobic energy production. Now, most people, even, and this is important, deconditioned people, they can maintain, you know, aerobic respiration, you know, aerobic energy generation for quite some time before they click into anaerobic. What Rob's work is showing is that people with ME/CFS and long COVID who have PEM, even with the slightest level of submaximal exercise, they switch over to anaerobic. So their body just starts producing lactic acid almost immediately. And that means that they're not even utilizing the oxygen that's going through their system to make energy. Their body, their energetic system is disabled in such a way that it immediately starts to use this anaerobic strategy. And so continuous lactate monitors could give us a really good insight into, you know, how severe one's PEM is. And we actually have some data that some colleagues will be presenting at a conference in just a few weeks, actually, here in the States, showing that the more severe of a day that people with ME/CFS or long COVID were having with regards to PEM was related to higher levels of blood lactate when they were taking their lactate measures. So I think that that's a really promising lead for being able to study what's going on. You know, I also think that we need to think about David Systrom's work as well out of Harvard, where he has been showing this reduced oxygen extraction in the blood, again, indicating that even though you're oxygenating your blood just fine, you're breathing in, you're taking it in, it's being circulated around your body is not extracting the oxygen to use it for energy production because it's already just in that anaerobic, mindset and producing, lactic acid.
What a great explanation. I'm pretty sure our listeners will really appreciate that explanation. But it, for us in Australia right now, I mean, we're constantly having to talk about PEM. And in fact, World ME Day for the next 3 years is going to focus on various aspects of PEM. So, yeah, that explanation was really helpful, especially for me. So thank you. Moving on, I'm also very interested to understand more about the collaborative work you're doing on off-label antiviral therapy for long COVID. I'm interested in antivirals generally because, of course, in Australia, particularly antivirals for long COVID, very restricted to, you know, people over the age of 70 or people who are immunocompromised or frail or whatever. People with ME/CFS who get COVID are actually generally, if they don't fit into those, or if their GP doesn't see they fit into those categories, they exclude it from being able to have antivirals, which is like totally ridiculous. And we're advocating for changes to the guidelines around that. But I'm really interested in this topic from your perspective, antiviral therapy for long COVID. So can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah. You know, there's a couple of trials that we're running right now looking at repurposing antiviral drugs. We have two trials that are sort of midway through right now that I would call repurposed HIV drug trials. So one of the drugs that we're using is the generic name is for Truvada, and it is a drug that has been shown to have fairly aggressive anti-EBV properties. So a drug that really goes after Epstein-Barr virus, but also may have actions on other herpes viruses. The other drug that we're repurposing is called Maraviroc. It's not an antiviral per se, but it actually blocks the access of viruses to certain receptors that they would usually use to enter cells. And it also sort of blocks the activity of inflammation as well. And so it's an interesting drug that allows the immune system to deal with intruders without, you know, having them allowed to sort of like escape by entering a cell. And in both of those trials, we're fortunately, they are double-blind placebo-controlled trials. So we're about halfway through, and we really hope that we'll be done shortly to look at the results. But we're doing deep immune profiling on every single person who is enrolled in one of those trials. So even if it's a failed trial, we'll understand why it failed, who responded, who didn't respond, et cetera, et cetera. We also just published a paper that was a case series. And a case series is not a formal clinical trial, but it happens when a provider prescribes drugs to patients in a clinical setting and monitors their outcomes over time. And we collaborated with a doctor by the name of Skip Pridgen, who is sort of a general surgeon down in Alabama. And he's a brilliant guy who really thought about the reactivation of these pathogens as a good theory for why people with long COVID might be sick, as well as viral persistence. And what he did was he combined two very broad spectrum herpes virus medications, one called Valtrex, which is valacyclovir, which is a targeted herpes antiviral. The other is a little bit more surprising. It's called Celebrex or Celecoxib. And most people think about that as an arthritis drug or an anti-inflammatory drug. But because it acts on a receptor called the COX-2 receptor, that is actually the receptor that allows herpes viruses to enter cells. So because of its action on the COX-2 receptor, in combination with the valacyclovir, it makes herpes viruses more vulnerable to the valacyclovir and to also the body's own immune system. And so this combination appears to be really effective at taking out herpes viruses. So we, in Skip's study, the data that we analyzed showed that folks significantly improved on this combination of valacyclovir and Celebrex, but they improved even more if we added a course of 15 days of Paxlovid into the mix. And something that was even more extraordinary than that was the folks who improved on that combination, when we followed up with them 500 days later, they were reporting maintained improvement. Durable effect off the medication after a long course. You know, it was 120 days on the medication and high doses. But at the end of the line, the majority of folks were feeling much, much better, a really noticeable difference. And this is not to say all of them were cured. It's just to say that they were experiencing a noticeable improvement. And then on top of that, it was a durable improvement. So based on the strength of those results, we're moving into a proper placebo-controlled, randomized controlled trial with this combination therapy. We hope to start in the next month on this particular trial. It's very exciting.
Oh, it's hugely exciting. I guess I'm trying to put myself now in the position of someone with long COVID in Australia who's desperate for answers. And they may be listening to this recording going, well, that's all happening in the US. You know, when is it likely that we get anything, any movement on anything in Australia to help us?
Yeah, you know, I think when it comes to sort of like off-label usage of medications, it quite frequently falls upon the provider and the trust that the provider has with their patients to sort of navigate those waters.
They're very difficult waters to navigate and very delicate.
Absolutely. Delicate. And, you know, one of the things that we have been quite transparent about, even with the manual that we've released, has been really to try and help coach people on exactly how to broach the topic of off-label usage with a patient responsibly and completely inform them of the risks and the benefits, and then, you know, gain consent and move forward. And, you know, the way that we do things in our clinic is our providers will talk to patients and say, here are the publications, here's why we think that we want to do it. You know, based on your blood work, here are the things that could go wrong and here are the risks. And it's up to you. Do you want to do it? You know, and sometimes patients say no and sometimes patients say yes. But, you know, what I find very frustrating is when there are publications to support certain approaches, when patients have found those publications and are saying, hey, I really want to do this, and there's no good reason to deny them and they're still getting denied. You know, that's an area that I think we need to work on, because we're removing personal autonomy from a patient's clinical journey when we do that. And I think sometimes we forget that people do have a right to autonomy, especially if they're informed. You know, informed consent means informed. And just because there's a power differential between patient and provider doesn't mean that you get to just say, I don't care what publications you bring to me, I'm just not doing this. You know, I'm not going to say that that should never happen. I'm just going to say that that doesn't feel like a collaborative way of engaging in practice.
Yeah. And of course, there's a huge issue around that. And that is, you know, we are involved in clinical education in a number of different ways. And, you know, most of our GPs just don't know. You know, they don't necessarily have the data to be able to then talk to the patient about, well, have you heard about the recent studies? Because they're just not there. And that's not their fault. But, you know, the challenges about communicating the information that is happening, let's say, in the work you're doing to our people in Australia, I mean, there are huge hurdles to overcome in that. And it is challenging, although I'm not sure if you're aware that one of our leading GPs here in Australia, Associate Professor Bernard Shue, has recently become the inaugural chair of the new RACGP post-infection and energy limiting disease group. So it's a special interest group now that's been put together by the RACGP that is broad enough to, in its remit, I think, to have input from people such as yourselves and the research that's happening overseas to see what can be done, because it's not just about the transfer of information from doctor to patient. It's about some of the regulatory frameworks that govern what GPs in Australia can and can't do that makes it very, very complex.
Yeah, I totally agree with you, you know, and, you know, I never want to sort of feel like I'm piling on or belittling clinical providers because they're working in a framework as well and they're busy and they're stressed and they're burnt out. And sometimes they're not their best selves with patients.
They're human beings.
But, you know, what we really need is coordinated education on how to deal with these things. And that has been a big portion of the work that I've been doing over the last 3 years and counting now, really focusing on scaling what we're doing beyond our clinic and trying to get other clinics going. Because first and foremost, you know, our clinic struggles all the time, you know, mainly because we're so overwhelmed all the time. We've got thousands and thousands of patients knocking on our door who are desperate, who are urgent, who are, you know, pushing in every direction that they can think to try and get care. And the best way for us to improve our practices and to not make unforced errors, you know, and not cause lapses in care is to make sure that there are as many centers as possible that have our skill set and our expertise around the country. So, you know, that's number one. That's the selfish goal. But number two is we need government to get involved, you know, across the world. You know, you can't engage, you know, we know that education works. You know, I have a statistic from one of my last educational sessions, which we're actually working on publishing right now, where I walked into a room with, you know, 200 or 300 primary care docs. And, you know, at a sort of initial interview, around 30% of them said that they didn't believe that these were legitimate diagnoses, these infection-associated chronic conditions. And by the end of an hour and a half education session, 0% held that belief. So we went from 30% saying, I am unconvinced by these diagnoses, to 0%, you know, everybody saying, well, I think there's something there. I still don't want to treat it, you know, maybe, but I think that there's something there. And I think that these are real conditions. And so that's a snapshot of the power of education. These are not people who don't want to help. These are people who don't know how to help. And so now what we need are governments to sort of grind the gears and say, okay, we've got a huge problem and we need to re-educate a whole lot of people who are out there providing care to what is now probably 10, 15, maybe even 20, depending on the study you read, percent of the population.
Yep, no, I totally agree. So I'm going to ask you one more because I know time is running out and I've got so many questions that you're raising in my mind. But I was speaking at an event with one of our support groups on Tuesday and one of the people there mentioned virtual reality. And I went, Well, I'm speaking to Professor David Petrino, and your team has successfully utilized virtual reality technology for long COVID rehabilitation. How does that work? I'm absolutely, you know, enthralled by that. And the fact that I had someone who just suggested it off his own bat in the patient cohort that I was speaking to. So I had to ask that question.
Have we done that? So I think we do use virtual reality for a few different things. And virtual reality is extraordinarily powerful of a tool for things like chronic neuropathic pain, which many folks with long COVID do experience, new onset chronic pain. And certainly we have put some folks with long COVID into virtual reality and they've experienced pain relief. And that's very encouraging because it's such a cheap, ubiquitous way of providing non-drug care, which, as you know, so many of our folks with long COVID, ME/CFS, chronic tick and vector-borne illness, they have medication sensitivities and they have issues tolerating powerful medications. So anything that we can do that gets an effect without medication is always, you know, really something that we strive for. We've also been using a technology called audio-visual entrainment therapy, which isn't quite VR, but it kind of looks like VR. You put a little mask on your face and it plays different frequencies of light and auditory tones in your ears. This is a really interesting technique that has been useful both for chronic pain and PTSD. And actually, on the back of the clinical trial we just completed, it just received a class one designation with the FDA as a device that can be utilized for chronic pain care. So these are some of the tools that we've been using for dimensions of long COVID symptoms, specifically chronic pain. And they've been, you know, really quite effective. You always need to be a little careful. Some of our patients have photophobia or light sensitivity. And so putting them into an environment where there may be sort of bright lights can be challenging. Some of our patients have dizziness and vestibular problems. So again, you've got to make sure you're picking the right tool for the right patient. But as always, our approach is making sure that we can find the right tool for each person. And that means not having just one tool, you know, not just being a hammer and saying everything's a nail, but it means having that entire toolkit and saying you're going to respond to these four or five things.
That is so critical. And it is about treating each individual as, you know, as an individual. There is no one size fits all in this disease. I'm sure that our listeners will be very interested to hear about that and will probably want to read more about it and will go off asking their doctors about virtual reality. That'll be interesting. Look, the final major area, and we've already touched on, you know, integration and models of care and replication, what you're doing in other centres of excellence. But you work for the CORE Centre, C-O-R-E. And, you know, one of the things that Emerge Australia is really keen in our advocacy back to government to look at is coordination, priority setting, you know, ensuring that we have linkages between clinical services, cohorts, biobanks, biomarkers, trials, because it appears that whilst we have some good work happening in Australia, it's very much, you know, parallel play and we don't necessarily have coordination. And we certainly don't have any centres of excellence. And I note that I think you're involved in about four or five or, you know, in replicating the work that you're doing so that you can help others to do the same kind of service. You know, obviously in a country as huge as the United States. So can you talk a little bit about CORE and your integrated work and trial pipeline, and not specific trials, but just how you got that set up?
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things that we're always trying to support, and it's kind of been the mantra that keeps us going with all of the centers that we run, even before COVID came along, when we were running innovation centers for spinal cord injury and traumatic brain injury and what have you, we've always had this sort of idea of you never tell a patient there's nothing more that we can do. You always have one more thing up your sleeve that you can try. You're never stumped. You can always point them to a clinical trial. It may not be a clinical trial in your center, but it's happening somewhere else. And that's what we're always shooting for. There's always one more thing we can try. There's always one more thing that we can do. And pretty quickly, we came to the realization that you can only do that if you have a center that is a hybrid clinical and research center, where the researchers are very focused on pragmatic clinical trials and implementation science. So meaning clinical trials that are really going to show, hey, this moved the needle in the patient or this didn't, you know, not like animal studies that are 20 years from being ready. And that is not a dig at animal studies. We need animal studies, but it's just saying, if you want a center that is changing clinical practice, you have to let those take the back burner. And then on the implementation side, you also want to make sure that your researchers are getting a look at the real world environment to try and understand, okay, even if this performs well in a clinical trial, is it really going to perform well in a clinic? Because that's important as well. That's not a given. And then on the clinic side, we get providers who get to see exactly what the researchers are doing. So if they do feel stuck on a patient, they can say, hey, why don't you enroll in this clinical trial? Because you've tried everything else, but we've got this new thing and we've got this other new thing. And so it allows that sort of necessary hope of, even though we might be stuck for right now on the FDA approved treatments, look at all the things that we have open for you to try on the non-FDA approved experimental, you know, experimental in a responsible way under the auspices of an IRB way, where you can really dig in and see if this is something that can help. And so really, that's how we started things. With regard to the clinical pipeline, one of the things that we, again, just given the overall burden and the overall sort of number of patients that reached out to us, we realized again pretty quickly that we had to set up a lot of supportive care around the main providers, the nurse practitioners and the MDs who see the majority of our patients, so that patients felt as though they could connect with somebody. Doesn't need to be a physician, but a health coach, a care coordinator, a social worker, a neuropsychologist, so that even in the 3 months between one appointment and the next appointment that they have, they've got interaction with people who know the plan, who are aware of their care, their touch points, their lifelines. And if there is something that they need urgently escalated and maybe the doctor is too busy to sort of like see what's being escalated, they can tell the social worker or they can tell the health coach, and the health coach can sort of knock on the doctor's door and say, hey, this is starting to get urgent. So those were some of the things that we had to learn along the way, because we started to realize that people were just like going 7 months without being seen in our wait list because everyone was just so busy. And so we said, okay, how can we integrate as many allied health into the mix that do create these touch points and opportunities to reduce what we call fragmentation of care? Our clinic is an insurance clinic. So, you know, these are not like some concierge service that costs hundreds of thousands of dollars. This is like care that is being supported by insurance. And that was important to us as well. We hired a billing expert to really nail these things down so that we could do this. You know, and of course, we have a co-creation board made up of patients who initially were just patients from the community who said they would help us build the thing. And then we switched out the board with patients who were actually having lived experience in our clinic. So they could say, hey, when you did that, that really sucked, you know, or can you fix this? Or can you, you know, or this is really great. Don't change a thing. But, you know, getting that constant feedback on how the programs are changing and what's good, what's bad, what do we need more of, what do we need less of?
Yeah, well, that model, of course, is my dream. And the dream is unfortunately still quite a long way from realization. We've got a long way to go still in Australia to get that level of coordination. But definitely, you know, having those touch points in between the distance that you have between clinical visits, you know, I think is crucial. And we're probably operating at Emerge Australia as part of those touch points. The problem is that the endpoints aren't there for the patients. So there's a lot of work to be done. So we're nearly through. This morning I read that US Congress has instructed the NIH to develop an implementation plan for ME-CFS, for the ME-CFS research roadmap within 180 days. Is that something you're excited about?
You know, I am excited to see the current administration is putting a lot of effort into infection-associated chronic conditions and illnesses. They have been adamant about the fact that these have been ignored illnesses for far too long, and they've named specifically long COVID, ME-CFS, and chronic tick and vector-borne illness. I had the opportunity to participate in a roundtable around long COVID research with Secretary Kennedy and some of the sort of key players in health and human services. And they were well-versed in the literature and they were, you know, quite determined to move the needle on these problems in public health. So, you know, we're always watching and waiting. I mean, if you want my unfiltered opinion, government work always moves too slowly. You know, nothing can ever happen fast enough, but it is encouraging to see this level of engagement and attention from the government. And I really hope it leads to something tangible.
Well, they've put a time frame on it, which is interesting.
Yeah, that's always nice as well.
Yeah, the reason I'm interested in it is because Emerge Australia has a proposal before government for a very small amount of money to mount a national ME-CFS research priorities workshop, bringing all of our senior researchers together to identify priorities for ME-CFS research and energy limiting or IACIs, and put that together into a national ME-CFS research strategy that we would then put forward for significant funds from our Medical Research Future Fund. And if you've been listening to any of the dialogue around the MRFF, there's a lot of dialogue around the cap that's placed on that and having that removed so that more funds can be released. And this would be a major allocation that we've never seen before in ME-CFS research in Australia. So that's something that we at Emerge Australia are currently, we're raising money for this workshop, which is very, very tiny cost compared to the benefit that would eventuate if we could get our own roadmap, research roadmap up and running and have that national coordinated strategy. So that's why I was interested in you talking about that. Finally, David, what words of encouragement and hope can you give to our community who, our long COVID community, who, like others around the world, struggle with the limitations of their disease?
Yeah, I mean, I think all I can give in terms of hope is that, you know, once again, we just have so much research to look forward to. We have so many ideas that we are chasing where we're producing tangible results. You know, it's happening bit by bit. It's not happening fast enough for any of our liking, but, you know, clinical trials where last year I was sort of, you know, last year we were seeing clinical trial results where we would see incremental improvement, but statistically significant improvement. Now we're publishing papers with big effect sizes. You know, just this year we hope to see a monoclonal antibody trial getting off the ground with Invivyd's VYD2311, which is their newest monoclonal after PEMGARDA, which we think is extraordinarily exciting in its anti-SARS capabilities. And I think it is a very exciting target for people with long COVID. We will be, in just a few weeks, we will be releasing the results of our clinical trial from a novel device that's never been tried before on anyone. We did the first in human trial in people with long COVID. Devices from a company called Pharion, and it uses a technique called microtesla magnetic therapy. And in a placebo-controlled trial, the people who received the real therapy experienced significant improvements in their cognition just with 4 weeks of intervention. So that's a really exciting trial. Finally, you know, just this year as well, we hope to be initiating the first in human mitochondrial transplant clinical trial.
Oh, wow.
And so that is something that we hope can benefit both people with long COVID as well as people with ME/CFS. We're just going through the basic science work right now, but we hope to be moving into first in human later on this year. And it's very exciting. We're pushing. We are going as fast as we can. But I really do believe that there is good reason for hope.
Oh, that's wonderful. Look, it's just been a pleasure and a treat talking to you again today. I could go on for hours because I've got far long, but you are busy and you want to have a rest at the end of your day. And we've got our day commencing here in Australia. Professor David Petrino, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for the work that you do on behalf of patients the world over. And we really, really look forward to the results of some of the amazing work that you're doing in the long COVID, ME/CFS and IACI sector. And we're certainly moving as Emerge Australia into that IACI space as well, because we have so many patients come to Emerge Australia with associated conditions. And, you know, there's so much overlap in these conditions. And, you know, we see these patients, but we hear what you're doing. We're excited about what you're doing. And we're so proud that you're an Aussie. And we wish you were in Australia. So there you go.
Well, thank you for having me. It's great to chat.
Yeah, fantastic. Thanks, David. So today's podcast is part of a clinical series that Emerge Australia is recording with people of influence like Professor David Petrino. This is a platform where we can together explore the pressing issues faced by 250,000 people with ME/CFS, at least 400,000 people more with long COVID in Australia. And this year, on Long COVID Awareness Week, we've chosen to focus on the long COVID aspect of Professor Petrino's work. Please tune in again for our next interview, and don't forget that for more information and to subscribe to the Emerge Australia newsletter, visit our website on www.emerge.org.au. David Petrino, thank you. We appreciate you a lot, and bye for now.
You may say that I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one, and I hope someday